Just a couple of words about the readings for this week. Or first, Greg or Rob, do you have any announcements? You're all set. This reading by Alan Wood is a very dense reading, as you've discovered if you've tried it already. Alan Wood was a philosophy professor at Cornell, an excellent philosopher, went to Yale afterwards, and then I believe his wife got a job at Stanford, so he took a position in philosophy at Stanford. I don't know if he actually published this later or not. It was a working paper that has been very widely used because it's probably one of the best short pieces on the subject of relativism. It's rather dense, as I indicated, and sometimes in the past, a few students have thought his tone was rather arrogant. He starts out, for instance, in that second paragraph, about saying, where is that, that few first-rate philosophers are relativists, and the way he says that irritated some people quite a bit. He's actually quite correct in that. There have not been many first-rate philosophers that have been relativists. Most of the relativists are found in the social sciences among anthropologists and psychologists and so on. And in departments of education, they're endemic in schools of education and departments of education, and that is one of the reasons relativism has become so common in K through 12 education and why it's so commonly found at some levels among college students, because it's basically what you've been taught in most school curricula. I really urge you to take the paper seriously, even though it's a fairly difficult paper. I can't repeat some of the arguments myself without going back and reviewing them rather carefully, because they're very tightly argued. But do your best to refute Wood if you can. If you can refute him, you'll gain an immortal place among the ranks of philosophers. I would guarantee you that. But he's not an arrogant person at all. He's far less opinionated than I am. Very modest, retiring person. But when he writes philosophy, he does as many philosophers do. He goes for the jugular vein. He doesn't fool around being nice. It's not a therapeutic model. It's not sensitivity training groups. It's a philosopher trying to make his point as briefly and as effectively as possible. So I would urge you, don't be put off by the style. If you knew Professor Wood, he's a charming, very sensitive, thoughtful person, but he's a very tough-minded philosopher, and he won't fool around with stuff that he thinks is irrelevant. It's well worth reading two or three times, because the arguments here are very, very strong arguments. When I claim, as I do from time to time, that in K through 12 education you are indoctrinated in relativism, I mean that quite literally. By indoctrination, I mean when you are taught things as simply obviously true, but given no reasons at all for why these claims are true, and not exposed to contrary views that would challenge those beliefs. And that is a very accurate description overall of what takes place in K through 12 education. I've written dozens of articles, journal articles, on the subject, and I know K through 12 curricula extremely well. And thus, when I say you have been indoctrinated, which some of you found quite insulting, a couple of you told me you didn't like that at all. That's okay. I'm getting too old to worry about those matters. I really use the term very carefully, because successful indoctrination means that you don't know you've been indoctrinated. Successful indoctrination, the most successful indoctrination, is when you just take it for granted that that's the way the world is, and have never been exposed to contrary views. yesterday in the Cal Senate meeting, we had a proposal put forward to require Cal students, actually the requirement thing didn't quite go through, but to strongly recommend that Cal students take a, quote, a diversity course. And I strongly opposed the proposal in the name of diversity, because what I argued was that when you look at the courses that were proposed for diversity, they tend, many of them, to be reasonably relativistic, but that wasn't my main argument. When you look at them, they tend, almost all of them, to be liberal to left-wing in their ideology, which simply reinforces the one-sided nature of Cornell University as an institution that simply excludes politically incorrect views in many areas. And that's exactly what's happened in most of the K-12 education that's taking place in America today. You students have been indoctrinated in relativism because they've never been exposed to serious arguments to the contrary. And that's why a piece like this, I found in assigning it in past years, in some ways is reasonably upsetting. Because for some of you, although you've already had some exposure to these arguments in earlier class discussions in 407, for some of you, this is the first time you've heard a really coherent, powerful challenge to relativism, both general philosophical, epistemological relativism, and moral relativism. So it's a very, very interesting article, albeit very dense and very tough. Take it seriously. I urge you, it may be the most important single article in the course in terms of its long-term implications. Any questions that you may have right now on the piece? I will restrain myself. I do occasionally get some pleasure out of telling you you've been indoctrinated in this or that because I know it irritates you. But I will try to restrain myself and not do it too often. Any questions or comments before we go on? Okay. Thanks. Back to the drawing board. One of the points where I disagree with Ian Barber and his material on the philosophy of science, and I think it's an outstanding reading or I wouldn't assign it. I think it has an awfully lot in it of very great value. But I do disagree with him partly when he argues that the main driving force in science is curiosity and the quest for intellectual understanding. I think that is true, fortunately, among many individual scientists. Many scientists just have a passionate love for their disciplines. They would do science if they possibly could, if they were paid or not. They just can hardly not do it because these issues become so intriguing to them. But it seems to me what Barber overlooks, and I think in his later writings, he partly admits this because this is over 20 years old, is that the driving socio-political cultural force behind science probably is the drive to gain the kind of knowledge and understanding that gives you power over nature and over people. Science and technology are very closely coupled, and it would seem to me that he doesn't, in this piece, although in some of his later writings he modifies this judgment, he does not adequately pay attention to the fact that it is the quest for control and power and predictability that drives much of modern science. Clearly, it's a key factor in terms of the funding of science. The military's interest in weapons, the interests we have today in countering terrorism, the powerful economic interests in the pharmaceutical industries and in industry in general, all of these, I think, are driven less by simple curiosity than they are by such issues as security, power, predictability, and so on. Now, that's not to put down science. And I add this caveat once more. because my experience has been on exams, as you write about some of these issues, I've sometimes been interpreted as opposing or putting religion on one side and science on the other. That's not the case at all, because I believe that science is one of the great intellectual achievements of humanity, and our lives would be much the poorer without it. I think I've already commented that probably 8 or 10 or more of you would not be here today without modern medicine and science. I would not be here, and we've all benefited from modern science and modern medicine and so on. But what I want to explore this morning more fully is that this is a very, very dangerous knowledge. And that's one of the things where I think we have made great progress in the years, in the past 50 or 100 years. I've been very influenced by a book by William Leiss, L-E-I-S-S, called The Domination of Nature. Don't agree with all of his conclusions. He's a neo-Marxist, a very smart scholar. Some of his political conclusions are not attractive to me, but his analysis of modern science in terms of this drive for power and the kind of understanding that gives you predictability, I think is right on target. He uses a term which he borrows from some of the German sociologists and philosophers, Herrschaftswissen. German is a wonderful language. It goes on and on. And sometimes you have to wait a long time till you get to the verb or the effective word. They have phrases like the around the corner coming with vacationers going to the North Sea for the month of August to relax and have a good time bus. In fact, one of the best jokes is two German professors meet each other on the streets of Heidelberg, and one of them is looking very, very excited, and the other one says, "Hans, was ist los? What's going on? You look wonderful today." And he says, "Oh, I'm so excited." He says, "Professor Schmidt, in his World History, Volume 2 comes out today." He says, "Finally, we get to the verb." It's not quite that bad, but these words go on and on. Herrschaftswissen, knowledge for the sake of Herrschaft, domination or control or power, dominion. And according to William Leiss, and he draws heavily on other scholars, and much of my lecture today is borrowed directly from Leiss. I won't credit him for every idea because most of these ideas are his. According to Leiss, medieval man viewed the contemplation of reality as his highest goal, but modern man wants to dominate and control reality. He argues, and much of this would be true also, preeminently so for a philosopher like Plato, the contemplation, the intellectual understanding, just for the sake of understanding, developing a sense of awe and the mystery of life, this was seen as the highest human goal, just as it is among many contemplatives today, for instance, among many Buddhist monks, among Taoists, among some of the Catholic monastics. But that this was seen as utterly central to human existence. He argues that a critical point in the change that we've seen in the modern world, because he believes that modern man wants to dominate and control reality by contrast, that a critical point in this change was the goal of the new science to free scientific investigation from all religious and metaphysical assumptions. Nature was to be viewed apart from all value judgments. Now, that was a very smart tack in a way. The scientific method or methods rely very heavily on bracketing much of our ordinary experience. As Barber points out, the scientist takes a kind of a very narrow view of the way the world is. She neglects beauty, goodness, feelings. All of these are rich and essential and important parts of our lives. Rather, she focuses very ascetically, very specifically on what can be counted, what can be seen with the senses, observed with the senses, mass, energy, causality. This is a very restricted view of the way the world is. But it is an enormously important discovery that if you take that restricted view, you can find out some incredibly important things about the way things work. By bracketing or pushing aside beauty, goodness, truth with a capital T, feelings, and so on, you open up the possibility of gaining a kind of knowledge which has incredible potential in terms of giving you control. The German philosopher Max Scheler, M-A-X-S-C-H-E-L-E-R, who actually coined the term Herrschaftswissen, wrote this. He said, knowledge for the sake, he referred to Herrschaftswissen and knowledge for the sake of domination and control. He writes, quote, to conceive the world as value-free is a task which men set themselves on account of a value, the vital value of mastery and power over things. In other words, they made this incredible discovery that if you could ignore value, beauty, goodness, truth, and so on, you could achieve another value very, very efficiently, namely the value of power, control, predictability. Now, you also get a kind of understanding that's very powerful, and of course, that's where Barber is essentially correct. In his discussion of Scheler, Leiss concludes, and I quote, the positive sciences, no matter how primitive they might be, are governed by a primary value in their approach to the world, namely the attempt to increase the power of man over the environment. One of the great discoveries of modern thought was the paradoxical conclusion that this primary value could best be served by viewing the world as entirely value-free. That is, as consisting entirely of matter potentially transformable for purposes of human use. View the world in this extremely limited, value-free way, and you very effectively achieve another value, power and control. Modern science ignores and thus, in a sense, devalues the subjective and qualitative dimensions of experience, beauty, the quality of things, feeling, goodness, truth, with a capital T, and so on. None of these aids us in gaining the kind of knowledge which gives us power. I'm not quite sure that Leiss is right about that, because I believe that in interpersonal relations, sensitivity to beauty and goodness and truth with a capital T often is one of the most winsome things in relating to other people. Yet this may be right, because at that level, this is not an attempt to gain power over people so much as it is an attempt to be in relationship to them. And this is a very, very universal, I think, an interesting experience that we have, is that often when we pull ourselves out of the subjectivity of the relationship, and part of us distances ourselves from the other person or persons, it's often in the attempt to gain power. When you're fully involved in a kind of I-thou relationship, just two people who are in love with each other, or two friends who thoroughly enjoy each other, or two colleagues who just are having a wonderful time working on a project together, you're fully involved with what you're doing and what's happening. It isn't the case then that part of you is standing off to the side observing, either for the sake of improving yourself or understanding the other person in a way that gives you control over that relationship. So in one sense, Leiss is right about that, even though I'm not sure that's the most felicitous way to make the comment. None of these, he argues, aids us in gaining the kind of knowledge which gives us power. Leiss points out that in the modern world, we have until very recently, that is up until roughly World War II in particular, tended to be casually optimistic about the role of modern science. Human beings would learn the secrets of nature, we would gain control over nature and over ourselves, society, and the life of the individual would inevitably improve. It's very hard for us today to grasp how incredibly optimistic Western culture was in the 19th century, really up until about World War I. It was just a sense that everything is possible. We're getting better in every way. We're going to overcome disease and war. Science, technology, education will save us all. And this is one of the reasons why, for Europe particularly, World War I was such an utterly shattering experience. The spectacle of the brightest and the best going up against the machine guns, coming out of the trenches and just getting mowed down by the tens of thousands because of technological developments that made old styles of warfare obsolete. This was absolutely shattering to the confidence of European culture. It didn't hit America quite as hard until the Great Depression in the late 20s, early 30s. It hit almost everybody hard with the advent of the death camps, the gulags, the hydrogen bomb, the bombing of Hiroshima, and so on. It's very, very hard for us today to really understand what a big change that was. Because I think your generation, much, much more so than mine, your generation, and even more so than my parents' generation, you've grown up with some very, very big questions about science. You have grown up in an age of nuclear weapons and the possibility of bioterrorism and so on. So I think it's hard in a way for you, somewhat hard for me, but very different for my parents' generation, to understand how big this change really has been. And what I find incredibly fascinating is that this fear that today we, to some degree, take for granted is a very, very ancient fear among human beings. Much of ancient mythology touches here and there on this kind of fear that humans developed as our technical skills increased. Once we began to learn to control fire, much more so when we began to refine metals, began to build engines of war, there was this very strong, latent, coming out into the open fear that we were the creatures that could just destroy ourselves. And it's very, very interesting that humans sensed this already thousands of years ago, that they sensed at a very deep intuitive level that the kinds of power that humans had was at best a double-edged sword, that it could bring great blessing and it could bring a great curse. It was seen that knowledge could be the source of damnation as well as salvation. There may be an element they saw of the demonic in our relentless quest for more and more knowledge about nature and ever-increasing power over nature. One example, the myth of Daedalus and his son Icarus. Daedalus was a craftsman, an artist, an inventor in archaic times. He was born in Athens, but he had to leave the city because he had killed his nephew Perdix, in part because Perdix was more skillful than he was, and he was envious of his skills. He went to Crete, where, among other things, he fashioned the labyrinth for the Minotaur. But he was later imprisoned by King Minos along with his son Icarus. And then they fashion, so the story goes, some wings out of wax and other materials to enable them to escape from the Minotaur, from the labyrinth. Mind you, it's a story, it's a myth. They do this, and they're successful. But Icarus, in his youthful exuberance and his feeling of power, and now we really can do what we want, flies too close to the sun, and the wax melts in the wings, and he crashes to his doom in the Aegean Sea. Now, on one level, obviously, the story is scientifically impossible, but that's not the point at all. The point is that it reflects some of this sense, this latent suspicion and fear that science may not be as singularly good as we had thought. Lice points also to figures like Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, and he points to the way he interprets this myth. Bacon was one of the early propagandist is the wrong term, a kind of public relations person for the modern science. He was really trying to convince the royalty and others in power that science was the way to go for the future. And Lyce points out that Francis Bacon took Daedalus's admonition to his son to fly neither too high nor too low, simply as a common reminder to steer a middle course between two extremes. Thus, Bacon fails to see, according to Lyce, the power of the myth, the sense of foreboding which it contained, the fear of the implications of human artifice and technical skills. Much closer to our own day, you have figures like the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell, who read far deeper implications into the Daedalus myth. In his pessimistic book, Icarus, or The Future of Science, Bertrand Russell takes Icarus to represent, and here I'm quoting Lyce's description, quote, not just a particular misjudgment, that is the failure to strike a golden mean between extremes, not just a particular misjudgment, but the fate of an entire civilization which had dedicated itself to the pursuit of scientific progress. At the turn of the century, when Russell wrote these words, his position would have seemed to most readers as unduly gloomy and pessimistic. But today, I think most readers, if anything, would judge that Russell was too optimistic. Because more and more writers over the past 50 or 60 years have spoken of dystopias rather than utopias. The term utopia is a little confusing because utopia literally means no place. It has the popular meaning, and I think justifiably so, of meaning an ideal place as opposite to dystopia, a dysfunctional place and so on. But literally, utopia means no place. It's an imaginary place, not the world we actually live in. I think of writings like George Orwell's 1984, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, or Zamatin's We, a whole genre, and more recent things in recent years, describing some of the potential effects of modern technology, modern bureaucracy, and so on. For us today, the conquest of nature, learning to control and dominate nature, seems to be anything but an unambiguous good. Let me return to Francis Bacon and the period preceding him. As Mircea Eliade, a wonderfully interesting writer, he is a kind of cultural historian and writer of Place of Religion and Philosophy and Science in Culture, as Eliade and quite a number of other historians of religion and culture have pointed out, there may be a far closer connection between medieval magic and alchemy on the one hand and modern experimental science on the other hand than most of us today realize. This is an incredibly fascinating subject. I wish we had time to do two or three lectures on it. His basic thesis is that the goals of alchemy and astrology and so on, that the goals of these were actually far closer to the goals of modern science than we sometimes realize. In Eliade's book, The Forge and the Crucible, he presents an incredibly interesting picture of the history of mining. Points to the fact that metals were seen as almost sacred. They had a kind of strange and mysterious character, people thought, and mining and metallurgical operations were surrounded with almost a cult-like religious aura. There was a sense of awe and fear, perhaps even suppressed terror, Eliade writes, connected with those who worked with metals. And I think his point is clear. There was a sense that maybe we're playing with something that's a little too big for us here. Perhaps no one really controls these new skills and their products, particularly when metals are used for weapons of war. So this is a very ancient fear that human beings have. And, of course, in light of what's happened in the modern world, Hiroshima, napalm, bioterror, these fears clearly seem more than justified. Eliade has some incredibly interesting stuff on the magician, the magus, M-A-G-U-S, the archetypal magician, and the role that the magician played during the Renaissance, a totally different figure than the magician today who just does tricks to amuse us. This was a figure heavily involved in alchemy, the belief that it might be possible to transform base metals into gold, and so on. Leiss notes that it's very, very difficult for us today to understand how widespread among the educated, not the ignorant, although it affected them too, among the educated throughout Europe was this interest in magic. If some of you read the book, my mind is tired, the book that the freshmen read, not Antigone, but the year before, Frankenstein. Frankenstein, you get a little inkling of this in the story there. Leiss refers, for instance, to the 1527 writing by Agrippa von Nettesheim, where he says, "Therefore, natural magic is that which, having contemplated the virtues of all natural and celestial things and carefully studied their order, proceeds to make known the hidden and secret powers of nature. For this reason, magicians are like careful explorers of nature, only directing what nature has formerly prepared. Therefore, those who believe the operations of magic to be above or against nature are mistaken because they are only derived from nature and in harmony with it." In other words, the magician wasn't just performing a bunch of hocus-pocus or sly tricks. The magician was really trying to understand the way the world worked. And one of the more fascinating points that Leiss makes is the incredible emphasis and indeed fascination that these alchemists had with numbers. And Leiss and other cultural historians have argued that this is one of the predecessors of the rise of modern science, which depends in an incredibly fundamental way on mathematics and the use of numbers. Frances Yates, in her book, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, contends that the Renaissance conception of the magus, the magician, was a critical step in the development of modern thought. Yates detects in the figure of the magician a, quote, psychological reorientation of the will toward action. Humans came to feel, she contends, that there was a real dignity in action, in changing the mundane world, and not just in the life of contemplation and meditation. The alchemist wanted to understand how nature worked. His methods were very different from those of modern science, but, and this is one of Lyse's key points, his aim was not dissimilar. The great alchemist Paracelsus I used to love to impress my kids with his name. It was Paracelsus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenstaufen. they loved that. It somehow flows. I think I always had a certain envy. The name Dick Bears, it's very brief, and I've always had a kind of envy for Italians and others who have these wonderfully flowing names, or some of the Russian names. The first car I ever owned, I named Poroshnichenko. Something deep in my, you know, it's fascinating how you, as you get older, you realize these odd things about yourself. Did I ever tell you about Band-Aids? Maybe it was a seminar where I said this, but I grew up during the Depression years, and I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, and these Jewish kids, their parents must have made a little more money than my dad, and they always had Band-Aids when they cut themselves and so on. We didn't have enough money to buy Band-Aids, and they also had chocolate milk, which we never had, and a couple other things, but I've noticed in the last 30 years or so, especially, you know, when I've had plenty of money, I am almost compulsive in buying Band-Aids and all kinds of duct tape, any kind of tape. It gives me a feeling of great security. And like, if you go to the house right now, I probably have 10 or 15 boxes of Band-Aids. And I think of all different kinds of way to use them. And I have rolls and rolls of duct tape and aluminum tape and clear tape. And it's very odd, but I think at some very deep level, it's like a security blanket. But sometimes as you get older, you realize that you have these odd personality features. Now I lost track. Oh, I know. It was names. I did envy kids with these Milano and all of these wonderful Italian names, but I'll get back on track. Just give me a minute. Another example of this, the Dr. Faustus legend was an incredibly widespread literary motif during this period and later, and became extraordinarily popular. Lyse argues that from a psychological standpoint, we see in the Faust legend strongly obsessive characters. The legend, he argues, presents us with a fundamental ambiguity, an ambiguity that is particularly well portrayed, incidentally, in Goethe's writings and also in Thomas Mann's novel. Lyse suggests that on the one hand, we have here an irresistible desire to command nature's secret powers, but on the other hand, the desire arouses a terrifying fear and sense of guilt represented in the story by the pact with the devil. Now, as Lyse suggests, and I think correctly, the alchemists of that time hardly had the kind of success that warranted such fears. Yet the fears were not altogether inappropriate, he argues, and I think he's correct, for somehow they sensed what might grow out of these endeavors. Thus, the Icarus Daedalus legend, the Faustus legend, and dozens and dozens of others were not so much a description of what was actually happening, although ancient warfare and the use of metals was a terrifying experience. It was at least in part an anticipation of the trajectory that humans were going, that we had these forebodings, this strong sense that we might eventually do things that would, in effect, destroy ourselves. And that's one of the one of the arguments that I find very, very interesting here, and I sometimes hear it from science colleagues, is the argument, hey, wait a minute, humans were afraid of fire, they were afraid of metals, they were afraid of gunpowder, so what's the big deal about nuclear bombs and bioengineering? It's just more of the same. And that argument has never, they don't put it quite that baldly, but that argument has never impressed me much, because it does seem to me that once we get to a level like nuclear bombs, bioterrorism, and the incredible technological power to reshape the environment and ourselves, I think that the quantitative differences in effect lead to a qualitatively different situation. So I'm not terribly comforted or encouraged when I hear this argument, well, people have always been afraid of technology, they've always been afraid of these things, you know, don't worry. I don't know what your response is. Mine is that that argument somehow fails to convince me very much, because I believe you really do live in a world that in many respects is very, very different from the world my mom and dad grew up in, for instance. Tuesday was my dad's birthday. He would have been 100 years old if he were still alive. And thinking back, that was an incredibly different world than the world we live in today. Let me pause here just a moment. I've got three or four more pages of notes, but I'd love to get a little reaction from you. What are you thinking? Am I unduly gloomy about where we are with science and technology? Does this seem to be reasonably accurate? What are you all thinking? Yes.
I think there is a big difference between how technology is developing now, because a lot of damage can be done with gunpowder and things like that, and that has led to a lot of death. But it's getting to the point where I think one man eventually could have the ability to almost wipe out everything.
This is certainly, this is certainly the argument that Bill Joy makes in this piece he wrote 2 years ago in Wired magazine, where he argues that this conjunction of bioengineering, robotics, and nanotechnology under the umbrella of computers, that it may quite well become technically possible within 10, 20, 30 years for one angry person to destroy the whole thing through interfering at some level that is so fundamental in the biological processes and so on that we would be in huge, huge trouble. And the interesting thing to me is that he's had so much positive feedback on his piece. Some very eminent scientists have said, hey, you're really asking the right questions, alerting us to the right things. Not so much the inadvertent dangers of biotechnology as how these this knowledge could be used deliberately by someone who had a mental break or who deliberately wanted to create mischief. Mm-hmm. Loud, please.
The world is a scary place, and I think Dr. Strangelove, the great thing to show that. I mean, it doesn't even have to be someone who's. It was in the Cold War, but it could still. I mean, there's still the power for that is even greater now, even though the tensions that set up that scenario.
Sure.
The idea that someone could, by mistake, set off a doomsday device is still, I think, plausible. I don't even know if it would have to.
Sure. Be. Sure. No, it's yes.
I think one of the reasons why we got to this state is that we kind of have this feedback system for our technology. Our quest is not as much for the actual science, because it's prompted by the fears we already have, the technology we've already developed. We have these guns, and so we're afraid of them, so we're going to develop more things to protect ourselves. It just kind of escalates.
Yeah, one of the issues that Bill Joy raises is, should we deliberately decide not to get certain kinds of knowledge? Is there some knowledge that is so inherently dangerous that we ought to try to get international compacts and so on not to go in those directions? Now, The problem with that is almost anybody who thinks about it, I think, would realize is it's probably not possible. You know, it's very, very hard to imagine what that would even look like. But I've had this rather pessimistic theory, which I don't really believe, but I think if there have been other sentient intelligent civilizations throughout the universe, my theory, maybe I've mentioned this before, is they got to about our level of development and then self-destructed. And that the period between science coming of age, particularly the development of radio and long-term communication and self-destruct, is maybe only a period of 100 years or so. And thus it would have been quite understandable that we wouldn't have had any contact with other. I don't really believe that necessarily, but it's an interesting possibility. Other thoughts? Yes.
I think in one sense, it's not so much the fear of one person getting control of some doomsday device that we have to fear, as we do the fear of everybody collectively becoming more powerful. I think that when you look at environmental issues, at least, I mean, one of the biggest issues is not, you know, for example, not point source pollution, but non-point source pollution. The problem when everybody, you know, when we all collectively, you know, make little screw-ups that add up.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
When you have, you know, when everyone has, it's if you have one rich guy who has a gun and no one else has a gun, there's a potential for him to misuse it and to misuse it greatly. If everyone has a gun, the likelihood that one person will misuse it is much greater.
Sure.
And the potential for everyone to misuse it is present.
I think this point is it's almost exactly the point that Louis Moncrief makes in an article in Science, that one of the big, big changes in the Western world was we were the first part of the world that had very, very widespread democratization and the rise of the middle class. There just aren't enough rich people to screw things up too badly. But when there are millions and hundreds of millions of people like us, maybe some of you are rich, I don't know. We all are rich in one sense. But when there are millions and tens of millions of people like us, it has a huge, huge impact on things like global warming and so on. I don't know how, again, there's no easy way to get around it. I'm curious, let me ask you one last question. I find that sometimes I even hesitate to make comments like those during the last 10 minutes or so because on one level they seem so paralyzing. What do you do after you've read Bill Joy's piece in Wired magazine and thought about some of these things? You almost think, what the hell? I mean, I might as well just enjoy life, what little there may be. How do you react to this kind of doomsday scenario, the potential for doomsday scenario? What do you do when you think about thoughts like that? I don't have a really good answer. My own answer, insofar as it goes, is I as a Christian believe that God somehow is still in control of the world. But I don't know. What do you do when you think thoughts like that? What effect do they have on you, or do you just sort of brush them aside as too disquieting and too big to think about at all? Yes, nice and loud.
Well, I would say, like, I would probably just brush them off. I mean, I would contemplate them and stuff, but if I don't think I have a solution, then you just kind of brush it off. But that's sort of, I think a lot of people are doing that, and I think that's sort of where the big problem is. We just keep going, and we realize that there's problems, but we don't know how to fix the problem, so we just keep going anyways.
You know, in some ways, the problem is not totally different, and this may contradict what I said before, but can you imagine what it was like to be in medieval Europe and during the Black Death, when a third of the population just, and more in some cases, just is gone? In some ways, we're really dealing with a human problem, and I think one of the reasons it's so unnerving is that we have now lived through a couple centuries where it looked as if science and technology would help us escape our finitude, our mortality, our vulnerability. And now it's like the whole thing does an end run on us, and our science and technology becomes the greatest fear of all. So this, in a way, is, it's like we've been cheated almost, because we thought we had now within our power the possibility of controlling all these things, almost a divine-like power that was now within the reach of humanity, and now the whole thing backfires potentially. Does that make any sense at all? It's something like that, I think, is what's going on culturally. And why we spend a lot of time on science and so on in this course is because I think the greatest danger today is not the danger that humans have faced historically, what nature can do to us. The biggest danger today is what we can do to nature, that we have this incredible power to destroy. It's very hard to know how to deal with. I'm running over, so let's stop there.